Okay. Where are we in the course so far? We're approaching the climactic phase of the Cold War period. This crisis that begins in November of 1958 with the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev's ultimatum about Berlin runs its course with various ups and downs to the end of the Eisenhower period and through the first 2 years of the Kennedy period, and climaxes with the Cuban Missile Crisis of October of 1962. Cuban Missile Crisis is not an isolated event. It's the climax of this great crisis in U.S.-Soviet relations that began in November of 1958. Cuban Crisis, Berlin Crisis, they're part of the same great historical event, the central episode of the Cold War. And how it was resolved will play a key role in determining the structure of great power politics for the balance of the Cold War period. Fundamental importance. This relates to our basic concern in this part of the course, which is this whole issue of how's the Cold War to be understood? What's driving it? And, connected with that, this whole question of how was the stable international order took place during the Cold War period. Those are two sides of the same coin. If we can understand what the Cold War is about, what the issue was that lay at the heart of the Cold War, then we can explain the emergence of a relatively stable international order by reference to how that core problem, that key problem, was resolved. Argument is that the German question lay at the heart of the Cold War. It had to, because this is the only area in which that basic rule about how the two sides could get along, only really important area where that basic rule didn't apply. This is the basic rule of Communists control things on their side of the line of demarcation in Europe, the Western powers on their side. The one exception to that is that the Soviets couldn't give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they wanted with Western Germany. And the problem from their point of view is that the Cold War, by its very nature, pushed the Western powers into accommodating the Germans, making the Germans into more of a partner, giving the Germans more in the way of their political rights, helping them build up their military power, and so on. In order to retain their loyalty to the West. And the more the Soviets were disturbed about something like this and applied pressure, the more the West was obliged to meet that pressure by moving further and further along this route toward building up Western Germany, giving Germany more and more in the way of sovereign rights and so on. Right? So that issue is central, and we try to get at this problem by looking at these various points in the history of this period when it seemed that a stable international order might be on the verge of taking shape, because the arrangements that seemed to be coming into being solved that basic problem, created an international system that everyone was prepared to live with. And what do we look at? 1945. The Potsdam arrangements, the kind of more or less friendly division of Europe into spheres of influence, including especially Germany. Then we talked about why that didn't work. Then 1949, the formal division of Europe into blocks, creation of the two German states and so on. Why did that not work? Because we know it didn't work. You have this huge crisis that develops the following year. And then the third time is 1954. 1954, the regime established by the Paris Accords. This was something that you might think should have laid the basis for a stable international system. Why? Because it solved the USSR's most fundamental security problem in Europe, namely the control of German power. German power would be contained in this NATO structure, the structure dominated by the United States. If the Americans weren't in, if the Americans pulled out of Europe, then how are you going to keep Germany down? The Germans would have this enormous incentive to become a nuclear power, if only to kind of keep the Soviets at bay. If the Americans weren't going to protect them, they have to protect themselves. The only way to stand up to another great nuclear power is to develop a nuclear capability of your own. You don't have to match them bomb for bomb and weapon for weapon. It's enough that you're able to create a nuclear force of large enough so that it can ride out an enemy attack and then go on to cause just unacceptable damage to the target country. That's all you need. The same reason the United States could not maintain a nuclear edge over the USSR forever. You know, that also implied that other countries would be able to neutralize Soviet nuclear power in much the same way. Right? So if the Americans were to withdraw, Germany would have an incentive to go nuclear, right? So those two things, the nuclear status of Germany and the Americans' willingness to remain in Europe, they're like two sides to a coin. All right? These 1954 arrangements, as I say, if they were taken seriously, if they had been put into effect, could have provided the basis for a stable international peace. Soviets would have gone along with it. Germans would have gone along with it because they were protected. Plus integrated in the West, and with all that meant in moral, political, economic terms. And the problem was, as we looked at it, that it was the Americans who decided not to go along with it. They accepted it very grudgingly in the first place, you know, with the goal, basically, of transforming it. Eisenhower had this basic concept, you know? The Europeans were strong enough, potentially, to defend themselves. Let them build up their power themselves. That's the way to become politically responsible. Take responsibility for their own defense. Now, don't just rely on this foreign power, the United States. You know, do it themselves. And if they couldn't do it on an individual basis for a variety of reasons, political reasons, people were a little leery of an independent Germany, a strong Germany. Let them do it on a Europe-wide basis. And if the British wouldn't go along, then a continental basis. Create a kind of continental European, West European bloc based on a Franco-German entente and have the other countries there, Italy, Belgium, Holland, and so on, you know, rally around that Franco-German core and create an independent, freestanding West European bloc. Eisenhower said, when that happened, we could sit back and relax somewhat, right? He wants to pull out. And again, American withdrawal implies European nuclear weapons, a European finger on the nuclear trigger. And if you're not going to have a truly united Europe in the sense of a true pooling of sovereignties, the United States of Europe, a common parliament, a common president, or whatever, you know, and if all you can hope for is, you know, a bunch of European nations that are cooperating with each other in some larger institutional framework, you know, European framework, NATO framework, then that was fine too. You know, it's simply a knitting together of these national nuclear forces. If that was the most you could hope for the time being, then so be it, right? We want to get out. That implies that they should be responsible for their own defense. They should develop a nuclear capability. And I mean, although there were people in the American government very leery of the idea of German nuclear forces, Eisenhower himself wasn't. You know, I told you this a couple of times, you know. Germany was a problem when Russia was weak. Now that Russia's strong, Eisenhower says, I'll take a strong Germany. That's pure realism, pure power politics. You know, it's like, you know, it's not talking about communism or they can't trust the Germans because look at the way they behaved in the past. That stuff doesn't mean anything. It's the sheer power realities that lie at the heart of that whole way of thinking. Okay? And so that's the problem here. That you want to know why the 54 arrangements didn't work? It has to do with the Americans. Right? I want you to just think about the implications of this point. It's like, you like to think that if people have good intentions, that everything's going to kind of work out in the end. That if you have problems, it's because, you know, a certain degree of nastiness in international affairs. But if, you know, if people are basically good, then you're going to work things out. This shows you that that whole way of looking at these things is not necessarily correct. I mean, we've seen over and over again in the past, and no one doubts Woodrow Wilson's good intentions, but look at the consequences. You know, the same sort of thing about Eisenhower. You got to admire Eisenhower's concept and sympathize with what he wanted. You know, it's like, this is not Imperial America with Americans throwing their weight around and trying to exercise as much power as possible. You know, he doesn't like that. We're not cut out for that role as a nation. It's not good for us internally, right? What we want in terms of allies are not satellites who will do our bidding and allow us to, you know, make all the key decisions. We want, as friends and allies, countries that are responsible and serious, that defend themselves, you know, that can chart their own course in international affairs. You see, isn't that admirable? And yet, look at the consequences, right? Basically, it's like taking a battle axe to the 1954 system and preventing it from working, because the Eisenhower strategy leads directly to this great crisis that begins in November 1958, Berlin crisis. Why? Eisenhower's whole notion, America should withdraw, the Europeans should defend themselves. It implies German nuclear weapons, and they move ahead in that direction. By the end of the Eisenhower period, the European allies, including the Germans, have effective control of American nuclear weapons. Plus, we want to help the Europeans develop their own nuclear forces, especially if they do it on a multinational basis. We want to help them develop a nuclear infrastructure under Eisenhower. Can't do this openly because there's this law, the Atomic Energy Act, that says that this kind of thing is illegal, but they have a variety of legal fictions that allow them to do, in effect, an end run around the law. The law says these weapons have to be in American custody. The custody arrangements are deliberately designed to be a sham, but since they exist, they could say, oh, well, we're in compliance with the law. Meanwhile, they're telling the Europeans the law doesn't mean anything because effectively you have this control. And, you know, and the custody arrangements are, you know, a bit of a sham. You had these American sentries standing on the end of the runway with a weapon. Lots of times it didn't even have live ammunition, you know. And then there was a fighter bomber with a German pilot on the runway, you know, on strip alert, you know, ready to take off and at will. Fully armed with nuclear weapons that could be used, you know, just at will, and what would happen if this plane took off? The American sentry is like an 18-year-old kid, you know, wasn't even told what he should fire at. And say, but people looked at this and said, this is just kind of craziness, you know. How can these custody arrangements be so lax? Well, they were designed to be lax. Because effectively, under Eisenhower, we wanted the Europeans to have control of these nuclear forces. You know, it was in line with the NATO strategy. I told you all about MC-48, very important in this context, linked to all these ideas about America wouldn't be able to defend them indefinitely anyway, because our margin of nuclear superiority was wearing thin as the Soviets developed a survivable nuclear capability. You know, it took them longer to do than people thought, but they were clearly going to do it eventually. And as it turned out, by September 1963, that's another key point. It was at that point that President Kennedy was told by the group that was supposed to be monitoring these things that America no longer had a first strike capability. That no matter how fast we struck and how hard we struck, the Soviets would have enough left that survived that attack to kind of go on and destroy the United States as a functioning society, right? And everyone kind of could see this coming. People, as a matter of fact, were surprised that it took the Soviets so long to develop a capability of that sort. And I told you about this with the whole, how that was like the taproot of the whole bureaucratic politics theory in political science. Okay. So, so you have this this move toward arming the Europeans de facto with American nuclear weapons. And they wanted to move yet further because something that kind of skirted the edges of legality wasn't terribly stable, and they wanted to put all these things on a much firmer basis. But it's very clear what way, you know, how the thrust of American policy. It's very clear that Europeans, especially the Germans, are very happy to have this kind of thing. And in fact, under Adenauer, the West German state has clear nuclear aspirations. Does it show how awful they are? No. It's like it's the most natural thing in the world for a country to want to defend itself, you know? To not want to place its destiny solely in the hands of a foreign power, no matter how well-intentioned, right? Adenauer wants to go that route. They can't quite do it openly, you know, especially, you know, they can't quite do it on a German national basis. So much opposition to that. And so it's like, let's create some sort of European force, independent of the Americans, but not a national force. And the Germans make this big effort to cultivate their relations with the French in order to kind of provide the basis for the creation of such a force. Well, all this is known to the Soviets. It's like there are few major countries in modern history that were so thoroughly penetrated by foreign intelligence as the Federal Republic of Germany. You know, it's like the easiest thing in the world to do. As I was telling you, during this whole period, you can move relatively freely from East Germany to West Germany. You know, once an East German is in West German, they speak the same language, they automatically have citizenship and so on. They could be easily taken into the German national security establishment. And so there are like hundreds of these spies of the East German authorities had been able to infiltrate into the West, who had penetrated the whole West German security establishment, you know, reporting back to the Soviets, all this sort of thing. Okay. Soviets know it. How are they supposed to respond to this? Well, at first they try going the soft route. This is in the mid-50s, after all this stuff becomes known. You know, MC-48, you know, receives a certain amount of attention at the time. Also, the whole NATO bureaucracy is thoroughly penetrated. Another thing is that France and Italy have huge communist parties at this period. France... it's like 20% of the population in this period voted communist. And these, you know, these people get jobs with the NATO bureaucracy. You know, it's then even based in Paris. And some of them were Soviet spies. There was a guy named Georges Pak, for example, who was a very well-known Soviet spy who was kind of discovered. Yeah, basically, they would tell the Soviets exactly what the NATO people were doing. I should say, to a certain extent, we knew about this. We knew that NATO was penetrated, but it didn't bother us. You know why? Because we knew that the Soviets were going to believe what they found out through intelligence channels much more than they would believe what a president said in a speech, for example. Because what's said openly can be dismissed as posturing. But what you find out through espionage is bound to be viewed as far more credible. So we left these intelligence channels open because we wanted the Soviets to know how serious we were about going nuclear in the event of a war. You know, for deterrent purposes. It's like, so they knew. how do they react? They're trying to head it off in the soft way. They're basically much weaker than the United States in the mid-50s. But they proposed these plans, they had the Polish foreign minister named Rapotsky proposed these plans for like a nuclear-free zone in Central Europe, you know, both parts of Germany and then say Poland and Czechoslovakia, nuclear-free, right? Oh, you know, the clear goal is head off German nuclear force, but you know, moving away from nuclear weapons, it's like, you know, comes across as a policy of, you know, supporting the peace, and it has a big appeal outside the Soviet Union. The Western powers aren't buying it. The only of the three of the four main Western powers, the only one that's interested in these disengagement plans or nuclear-free zone plans is the British, the French, the Germans, and the Americans. They don't have anything to do with this stuff. So it doesn't work, and we proceed along with the nuclear sharing to the point where, by 1958, as I say, even the Germans, the German Air Force especially, is armed with American nuclear weapons that are under its own effective control. You know, it's like, well, Soviets say the time has come for tougher medicine. We have this important source of leverage, namely the existence of West Berlin as a Western enclave, totally surrounded by Soviet military power. Very easy to exercise leverage on them. I once got into trouble because in a class like this, I actually quoted one of these kind of off-color remarks Khrushchev made about how easy it was to exert leverage. He referred to a certain part of the male anatomy and said how easy it was to squeeze it. So I'm not supposed to say any of this stuff, right, anymore. In fact, he loved using all these anatomical metaphors. You know, it's like, Berlin isn't the ulcer of the West, the corns of the West, you know, kind of thing. He was very well aware of how vulnerable the West was in West Berlin and how easy it would be for the Soviets to put pressure on them there, right? The Berlin crisis is not about Berlin. That's as clear as can be. It's not about East Germany and stabilizing East Germany and cutting off the flow of refugees, because they could do that very easily just by sealing the border. They deliberately decide not to do that because they want to keep this Berlin problem alive, because their main concern is to use it as a lever to affect what's going on in West Germany, especially the nuclearization of West Germany. Right? How do we know this, you might say? Well, we don't have the kinds of evidence about Soviet policy that we have, say, about American policy or even British, French, German policy that would enable us to kind of nail this down incontrovertibly. But, you know, you hold up all the different alternative explanations to the light, and you apply the two tests of logic and evidence, and it really does seem from what we have that the German nuclear issue is kind of the core issue. This one of the key sources that became available after I wrote that book was a very nice article by Khrushchev's foreign policy advisor, a man named Troyanovsky. And this is a book edited by Bill Taubman. Bill Taubman is the author of this really extraordinary biography of Khrushchev. And Troyanovsky basically says that the nuclear thing was that the taproot of Soviet policy, and is what they were really trying to drive at with the Berlin crisis. They're not as overt in making it known that this is their main concern, because to do so would be an admission of weakness on their part, that their policy is dominated by fear. And as the weaker of the two superpowers, they have to kind of compensate for their weakness by projecting this image of strength, we're 10 feet tall, we're made of steel, and so on. But in reality, you know, the evidence was there. Okay. What happens then? As I say, they lay on this crisis in Berlin, November of 1958. How do the Western powers react? Basically, The Eisenhower policy is, we don't want to take too tough a line at this point. Of course, we could force them down. We could humiliate them. But that's not to our interest. We don't want to take a tough line because we know we're strong now, yeah. But we're not going to be, we're not going to have that edge forever. Sooner or later, we're bound to lose our nuclear advantage. So doesn't it make sense to negotiate with the other side when we're still strong? Right? We're going to get better terms if we reach a settlement now that we're strong than if we waited until we lost our nuclear edge. Right? This is the thinking. And so the rhetoric is relatively restrained. We're not going to be pushed out of Berlin, but on the other hand, we're willing to talk. And Eisenhower also has the views of the Allies to consider, much more vulnerable to a nuclear attack than the United States is, especially the British. Very cool about the whole idea of going nuclear. Even the Germans. The Germans have their posture is like very tough and against the whole idea of talks and so on. But when Secretary Dulles goes over to talk with the Germans, and this is in December of 1958, and I should say, Dulles at this point, he was dying of lung cancer. So many Americans of his generation, he was a big smoker. But and so the dying Dulles goes over to West Germany. He talks with Adenauer about this issue. What are we going to do if the Soviets carry through with their threat that within 6 months or 5 months left at that point, they're going to cut off access to Berlin if we don't accept their terms? And then Dulles says, well, of course, eventually we're going to have to go nuclear. And Adenauer just kind of covers his face and says, for God's sake, not for Berlin. They're not willing to, go the whole nine yards. And actually, this is true of all three of the main European powers. America's much tougher about this. If we kind of rule out the prospect of eventual nuclear escalation, you could just kind of kiss goodbye to Berlin. And why is Berlin important? Because our whole political position in Europe, and thus in the world as a whole, is tied in with American credibility and America's willingness to defend West Berlin. Okay. So what happens during the Eisenhower period? Right? The six-month deadline is allowed to expire. Basically, the Soviets put it on hold because Khrushchev is invited to come to America to negotiate all these things. I should say he had this big disappointment when he was coming here. Disneyland in Orange County, it had just opened up. And he very much wanted to see Disneyland, and for security reasons they would allow him to see Disneyland. Anyway, so he comes over and to talk with Eisenhower. They don't actually reach any real deal or anything, but the fact that he was talking allowed him to save face by allowing the ultimatum to expire without consequence. Right? And then, so there are all these talks. 1960, there's supposed to be this big conference held in Paris, a summit conference, Eisenhower, Khrushchev, and the French and British leaders as well. De Gaulle and Macmillan were supposed to come. They're going to talk about Berlin. But it was clear from the nature of American policy that we were not going to give way on these essentials. And in particular, we're not going to give way on this whole nuclear sharing business and the whole question of the nuclear armament of Germany. So people expected that the Paris conference, Paris summit, May of 1960, was going to fail. And it was for that very reason, by the way, that the Americans, to prepare for the war, had these overflights of the famous U-2 spy plane. It flew very, very high, supposedly above Soviet air defenses. The notion was they couldn't shoot it down. The reason we sent that plane over was they wanted those photographs in order to identify all the targets we would have to hit. if push came to shove and there was a war, right? The Soviets shot down one of these planes. Khrushchev used this as an excuse for breaking up the summit. And people thought, oh, now that there's no summit, there's no chance for a settlement, the Soviets are going to kind of bring this matter to a head again. In reality, they let it drop. The interesting thing is very few people even notice the fact that they're not following through with their threats, or draw the inference from that these people are just blowhards. You know, it's all bluff and no reality. They continue taking these threats very seriously. Why do the Soviets not follow through with this? Well, the military balance is the obvious reason. It's very much like the 1949 story. Yeah, it's the military factors that kind of keep them from pushing their political goals. Right? Now, 1960, they're no position to risk a war with the West. America still has very much the upper hand in strategic terms. Dulles says that, it's like chess. We're in a position to call checkmate on the Soviets. We're so much stronger than they are that we don't even have to have a war. Just the threat of a war, could kind of, they're bound to kind of give way to us, right? That's the policy. So Eisenhower is not giving the Soviets what they want. He's unwilling to abandon his basic political goals, even though he's willing to kind of negotiate on these secondary issues, like should the East German police rather than Soviet soldiers be allowed to stamp the papers of Allied convoys going from West Germany into West Berlin. Eisenhower thinks all that stuff is kind of nonsense. We should be able to work those things out. But on the core issues, the really important political issues, oh no, not giving way. We're not going to abandon West Berlin. Okay? So the Berlin thing is on hold for the Eisenhower period. Okay. One interesting aspect of all of this that should be noted because of the seeds that are being laid here for future events. And this has to do with Sino-Soviet relations. As you all know, Soviet Union and China had been allies in the early 50s at the time of the Korean War. Soviets encouraged the Chinese to go in. Didn't help them very much, but they encouraged them to go in. By the end of the Eisenhower period, around 1960, these two countries are clearly at odds with each other. This is the famous Sino-Soviet schism. It's very important. Why is it important? Because it vastly improves America's position. We're now in a position to balance between Soviet Union and China. We don't have to even do anything. It doesn't call for any intelligent statecraft. It's the mere fact that they're at odds with each other improves our position vis-a-vis the two of them. If you have any brains at all, it's the easiest thing in the world to basically balance between the two, play them off against each other, and so on. Increasing tension between Germany on the one hand, Britain and France on the other hand, in the decade before World War I, put Russia in the driver's seat. It's like Russians don't have to do anything. Same thing also about 1939, exactly the same thing. Why was Stalin in a relatively strong position in 1939? Because of the growing chasm between Germany and the Western powers. Right? That's the way international politics works. The split is obviously important for those reasons. It's also important because it changes the American view of the nature of the international situation. It's not to be understood in ideological terms because here you have these two great communist powers, both communists, and they hate each other more than either of them hates the United States. Right? So how can you think of the Cold War in ideological terms? If Russia and China, these two great communist powers, find it so hard to kind of get along with each other. So there's this, erosion, because like an acid eating away at these ideological notions of foreign policy that are so widespread within the American political culture at that time under Eisenhower. Uh, The point here is, you look at Sino-Soviet relations, and there was a whole literature on this stuff, that tried to analyze the deterioration of relations in purely bilateral terms, as though these two countries were isolated from the rest of the world. I think the big insight is that it's American policy, deliberate American policy, as a matter of fact, that had the effect of driving these two countries apart. It's not an accident that relations with between China and Russia deteriorated so dramatically during the Eisenhower period, when Eisenhower had, you know, had the policy that he did, a policy which, in terms of its rhetoric, not in terms of the real thinking of people in the Eisenhower administration, but in terms of its rhetoric, pretended to see Russia and China as forming a single monolithic bloc, the international communist conspiracy. This is not the way these people really thought, but they took that line deliberately for political reasons. Right? You may say, well, why? What was the logic there? Say, if you want to drive Russia and China apart, how are you going to do it? By being nice to the two of them? No. Dulles explicitly said, Dulles, Secretary of State under Eisenhower, second most important person in the government. Dulles explicitly said, no, that won't work. Basically, we should take a tough line. Why would a tough line drive them apart? Well, suppose the United States got in a war with China over the over these kind of islands that were still controlled by the Kuomintang regime on Taiwan, are these islands that just lay right off the Chinese coast, Quemoy and Matsu. There were two Taiwan Straits crises in the Eisenhower period. First one 54-55, the second one in 1958. You say, this is the craziest thing in the world. How can you contemplate using nuclear weapons, you know, over something as trivial as these little tiny islands? What was the logic here? The logic here was, we want to create a certain sense that that war is possible, nuclear weapons might be used if this crisis over these islands leads, escalates. Why do we want to do it? Because with all this rhetoric of a Sino-Soviet bloc, if we get involved in a war with China, then the Soviets are bound to fear that these bombs are going to fall on Moscow. It's just that these Americans, they're so crazy. And so what effect does this have? It should lead the Soviets to do one of two things, either to distance themselves from the Chinese or to try and restrain the Chinese. Either of those two courses of action is going to place a burden on Sino-Soviet relations. It's going to lead to a deterioration of relations between those two countries. You know, Dulles kind of talks explicitly in those terms, in December of 1953 when he meets the British and French foreign ministers at Bermuda. Right? We can tear them apart. Right? These people are not a bunch of idiots, right? And that whole policy is contingent on people believing that they believed seriously that China and Russia formed a single monolithic bloc. We know it's not true, but if people saw that it wasn't true, then it would neutralize the effectiveness of that kind of policy. It's like, not dumb. Although they had a certain political interest in projecting the image that they were kind of obtuse. All right. That's one thing. Not an accident. The America factor is a key element in explaining the course of Sino-Soviet relations in the 60s, leading to this very important development, the Sino-Soviet schism. Not just that, there's another way all this stuff connects. I mentioned before that Khrushchev came to America in September of 1959 at Eisenhower's invitation to talk about all this Berlin stuff. And Khrushchev says, and you look at the notes of this meeting, when he meets with Eisenhower, it's at this presidential retreat in the Maryland Mountains, not far from Washington, called Camp David meetings. Khrushchev says to Eisenhower, well, you know, there's this inconsistency in your policy, in the American policy. You know, when when it's a question of China, you're perfectly willing to have like a two Chinas policy, that the way you want to stabilize the China thing is that everyone should recognize things as they are, that both China, the People's Republic of China, and the Republic of China on Taiwan, these are independent states, two Chinas policy. Is it? And then Khrushchev goes on to point out, but when it comes to Germany, you take a totally different line. When it comes to Germany, you don't want to agree to a two Germanys policy. You refuse to even contemplate the recognition of East Germany, you know, even though the Americans recognize communist regimes in all these other countries in Eastern Europe. Why is this significant? Because Khrushchev, in the indirect way, which is so common in diplomacy, he's proposing a deal. He's basically saying, look, why don't we both agree to the status quo in both of these cases, right? We'll agree to a two China settlement, and you agree to a two Germany settlement. Everything will be stabilized on that basis. Eisenhower is kind of obtuse. His answer is, "Well, you know, international relations is complex. He doesn't want to take the bait." But Khrushchev doesn't give up on this because on his way back to Moscow, he stops off at Beijing for talks with the Chinese leaders, and he basically tries to get the Chinese leaders to accept this kind of arrangement. You should accept the situation with Taiwan in order to enable us to get the Western powers to accept East Germany. Their goal is to stabilize the status quo in Eastern Europe, you know, recognition of East Germany, along with non-nuclear status of West Germany. That's their basic goal. Okay? Chinese are furious. They later say, during the height of the Sino-Soviet split, they say, Khrushchev tried to sell the Chinese on the American plot of the two Chinas. They will never accept this. Again, you can see how the larger context, this whole business with Germany, what's going on in Europe, has a corrosive effect on Sino-Soviet relations. Important part of the story because of what will happen later down the road. Okay. So as I say, under Eisenhower, things are basically put on hold. By Khrushchev. They are not going to run the risk of a war while the Americans still have the upper hand in strategic terms. And Eisenhower's policy had been tested, right? They knew the Americans were serious about war from all kinds of sources. They're not going to push it. And they wait. In 1961, a new American government comes in, January of 1961. This is the government headed by Kennedy. And what's Kennedy's policy and how does it differ from Eisenhower? Because practically as soon as Kennedy comes into office, all these Berlin threats start in again. Right? What's Kennedy's policy? It differs from Eisenhower. Kennedy also is a realist. Very much so, in fact, although his rhetoric gave an entirely different impression. But when you listen to the Kennedy tapes and you read all these documents, you get the sense that this is a guy who thought in kind of business-like, parapolitical terms. It's like he knew that the American nuclear edge was wearing thin and that its end was just a question of time. And again, he thought it's important that we, you know, reach some sort of understanding with the USSR, sooner rather than later. And what sort of understanding? One that respects the kind of core political interests of both sides. So let's deal with them on a business-like basis. And he arranges to meet Khrushchev at Vienna in June of 1961, and he lays out his concept of what the settlement should be. It's basically both sides should accept the status quo. Respecting the Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. You know, we respect your special interests in Eastern Europe, he says. I mean, I should say these passages had been deleted out of the version of these minutes that when they were first declassified about 20 years ago. And say, why was that? Not to keep what Kennedy said from the Soviets, because they obviously knew what he had said, because he was telling it to them, but to keep it from the American people, because they didn't want the American people to know that the degree to which they thought in spheres of influence terms and were willing to accept Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence. But Kennedy is quite clear about this. And he said, we also understand concerns about, you know, West Germany, especially about West German nuclear weapons. We share those concerns, he says. But what do we want in exchange? We want you also to accept our core interests, that our presence in Western Europe and our presence in West Berlin. And if we could just work things out on that basis, you know, we could have, we can get along with each other quite well. Right. This is the Kennedy offer at Vienna. Okay. Now, in pursuing this sort of policy, Kennedy has to face various problems. One, you know, what is the problem of getting the Soviets to accept? And you say, well, shouldn't they have just closed the deal? Kennedy is giving them everything that they have any right to expect, right? This is something they wanted. We're going to keep Germany non-nuclear. See, Kennedy's different from Eisenhower. He doesn't believe that America should withdraw from Europe and the Europeans should rely on themselves for their own defense. Kennedy thinks, you know, there is no purely European solution to the European defense problem. They can't defend themselves, especially because there's no united Europe, because any European defense is just going to be a knitting together of these national forces. It means you're going to have a German nuclear force, and that's a big source of instability, not just because of the Soviet reaction, which is serious enough, but in its own terms, because of the transformative effect it would have on German policy. Germany wouldn't be locked into the status quo the way she is as a non-nuclear state dependent on these other status quo powers for protection. Kennedy doesn't like that, and given that there's no, that a German nuclear force is, you know, out of the question, that means the Americans have to stay in Europe. Again, not because we want to be this big imperial power. Is because that's the only way of achieving our fundamental goals. And our fundamental goal is to keep the Soviets from taking over all of Western Europe, to provide an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. The Europeans can't do it themselves for those reasons. The Americans are stuck in Europe. And given that we're stuck in Europe, we gotta worry. We got to worry about where matters what might head. If, you know, if we don't have a political settlement, that might unleash a crisis, which could lead to the destruction of American society. We don't want to do that. If we're stuck there, our head is on the chopping block. And so we got to pursue an active policy aimed at stabilizing the status quo. Now, the problem with reaching for this is that the more you reveal yourself as desperate for a political solution, the more the other side has the sense of, oh, they're so scared of war that whatever concessions they're willing to give us now, this is just the beginning. You know, if the fruit is falling off the tree as it is, let's give the tree another big shake, and who knows what more fruit we're going to get. Right? This is a problem. If you want peace, you're going to make concessions, but the very fact that you make concessions is going to give a signal to your adversary that you're weak and an appeaser and lead your adversary to toughen his position, which might have the effect of increasing the threat of war. You know, it's a dilemma that a statesman like Kennedy had to face. Okay? Not just that, but so you have this problem of closing the deal with the Soviets for that reason, but you also had this whole other set of problems having to do with your own allies and getting them, getting the major European powers, especially the West Germans, but also the French and the British, to kind of go along with this thing, right? And so much of Kennedy's policy is to be understood as a war on two fronts. You know, trying to reach a deal with the Soviets and trying to lay the basis for getting your own allies to accept this arrangement. So let me break off now, And next time, it'll be the second half of this lecture, I'll tell you how things ran the course during the Kennedy period.